It's time for Tupelo Tom and Big Lou talking. And now, here's Tupelo Tom and Big Lou.
I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou. And
we're talking. I got to tell you, Jeff, I'm excited about this episode. We've got one of my heroes, Norbert Putnam. Interviewed him many times over the years, and he's just always one of those people. He's had such a career in the Elvis world, but also just in the world of music, and an amazing man. And I look forward to for us to all experience and hear his stories.
Well, I'm very excited about it. I'm obviously a massive Elvis fan, like we all are, but I'm also a huge Jimmy Buffett fan, Dan Fogelberg fan. Yeah. I just can't wait to hear his stories The history he's had in the music business is remarkable. So I'm really and if you ever meet him, if you get the opportunity, couldn't be a nicer guy.
Yeah. And we're recording this the day after the Oscars, the Academy Awards. We're about a week out from the Nashville Elvis Festival. And we just want to, you know, basically very quickly before we go on with Norbert here. If you guys are listening to this on the way to Nashville, March 21st through the 24th at the factory at Franklin, the Nashville Elvis Festival.com for all the details. Alex will be performing several shows. We've got some cool things that are going to be happening there. One of the ones, Jeff, that I'm most excited about is the Bill Cherry Memphis concert. He's recreating that concert from the Mid-South Coliseum that came out in the Elvis Recorded Live on Stage in Memphis album, of which the cover is Graceland. And he's recreating that. I was at that show on March 20th, 1974. And Jeff, we are doing this 50th anniversary tribute to that show 50 years and one day later. 50 years and one day.
And of course, Bill is so great, and he's going to do a great job on that show, and I can't wait to see it.
Being 14 years old, seeing Elvis live in concert at that show, and then 50 years and one day later, I get to be Charlie Hodge.
That's great.
You know, that's what I love. Alex is going to be a part of the festival. He's got some great shows lined up. You guys are recreating the 50th anniversary, you and Bill together, of Good Times.
I know. I'm excited. And actually, our guest coming up played album. How crazy is that?
If you have any song questions about interpretation or anything about some of the songs, he's on those songs from those sessions.
It's amazing.
As a bass player.
We have some after parties that I'll be doing at the hotel, but we also have a gospel show.
Yeah.
That I'll be a part of Sunday. And I believe that Norbert played on a lot of the Elvis gospel.
He did. The Christmas songs, the gospel albums, and the funky stack stuff from the 70s. Norbert was right there in the middle of it. And we've got Billy Blackwood and the Blackwood Brothers as part of the gospel on Sunday morning. Cody Daneth and Ben Thompson are going to be there recreating the 55th anniversary of 1969. We'll have Ben's doing American Sound, and Cody is doing the Las Vegas first engagement at the International Hotel. Dean Z is going to be a part of the festivities during gospel and on Sunday afternoon doing his Dean Z show. We've got Cliff Wright and Casey that are going to be there giving us their Johnny and June tribute, along with Michael Culifer will be there. So many people. Riley Jenkins, our reigning Nashville champion, will be there to do his triumphant, you know, performance during finals night. And he is doing the 70th anniversary of 1954. 54, 64, 74, some big years in Elvis histories for us to kind of hit on during the Nashville Elvis Festival.
And as a producer, like you and I and Alex all are, thank you, Elvis, for giving us a plethora, a voluminous amount of material that we can write shows from. He's the gift that keeps on giving, for sure.
Yeah, the opening night, the act one of opening night, we got the idea to have Ben and Coat and Alex and Culifer just pick four songs from one movie. Each guy pick a movie, just that hook to just kind of get things going with movie songs. Because like I said, all these things, we're doing these tributes to albums and to things. We're doing a tribute to Legendary Performer Volume 1, which came out in 1974. Riley and Culifer, Michael Culifer, are doing that. I love to do things in a way that gives you some information, because there's so many new young fans that are experiencing Elvis, and I want them to really understand what it is they're seeing. And because that really, you know, I worked at Turner Classic Movies, so we give context to things, to movies, and it's like, you might not know this. This makes it more interesting if you do know it. And yeah. So that's the fun of putting this together. So Brian Mays, my co-producer, and I will be bringing you the Nashville Elvis Festival. We invite you to visit NashvilleElvisFestival.com for tickets. If you're listening to this after the festival, wasn't it great? It was fantastic.
It was.
Oh, I could pick out so many wonderful moments, but I won't, because it was just so wonderful. But it's just great every year to put this on, and we're excited about it. And I noticed the clock on the wall is telling me we are ticking down to the arrival online here of Norbert Putnam. So, Jeff, let's take this quick break, and when we come back, the bass man. Maybe we might have to even tell him to wake up, but coming up... Norbert Putnam, right here on Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talking. Tupelo Tom and Big Lou, we are joined by, Alex Mitchell, of course, our producer, who we go nowhere without. But we also have an amazing musician and engineer and just raconteur. I would call him that, a raconteur, entrepreneur, and all around good guy, Norbert Putnam. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Putnam.
Well, good afternoon to you, my friend.
It's so exciting to talk to you again. We've done interviews so many times over the course of the years, and I always learn something new about your life and your career.
That's because I tell the story differently every time. you know what you do when you have to repeat these stories forever and forever, sometimes you'll change the ending.
Yeah.
Right. And then nobody notices, actually. So but today I'm going to keep it straight down the middle. Lou, it's a pleasure to see you and talk to you.
How you doing, Norbert?
Well, I'm doing just great today. You know, it's I'm here in what is called Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And Muscle Shoals makes up four little cities here on the Tennessee River. And it's about 65 degrees, but it feels 75 degrees.
Awesome.
And the dogs are happy. My wife is happy. It's a great planet.
Everything's cool.
Oh, that is great.
Norbert, over the years, the fans have gotten to know you. You've been around playing in the big screen Elvis show. Your chance to be kind of in front of an Elvis crowd, but your relationship, your musicianship with Elvis really began in the studios. And so you were working with Elvis kind of out of the spotlight of being in front of a live audience. Just as we start this for the new Elvis fans that are out there listening, because a lot of people are kind of joining the Elvis world now since the movie came out and discovering and learning things about Elvis. Talk to us about Elvis just as a guy, as a not as a musician or a singer, but just a guy that you hung out with in those studio sessions.
Well, yeah, but I have to preface all of this by the fact he's the only reason I became a musician.
Yeah.
The kids at my school were forming a band to play Elvis with Scotty and Bill. Remember when Bill would slap the bass, boom, tick-a-dum, tick-a-dum, right?
Yeah.
Well, that got me started, and then that led me into the Muscle Shoals recording scene. But I don't meet Elvis until I'm retiring as a bass player. I'm 28 years old. I've played on about 10,000 recordings in 28 years. And I was sick of playing the bass. I played it from 10 in the morning till 10 in the evening or 2 a.m. And when Elvis came to town, I played it till 5 a.m. You know, but let me tell you about Elvis. Before I met Elvis, I was standing in the bathroom before the session started, you know, and I remember looking in the mirror and saying, God, please don't allow me to screw up the first Elvis recording. You know, because he was such a big star, you know, he must have been 30 feet tall. So I walk in the studio, I'm waiting for him, and this guy comes in and he's wearing a cape, okay? And he's about my size, you know? But he took the cape off and he swirled it around and pitched in the air, and one of the guys in the mafia caught it. I think they'd rehearsed that, all right? And then Elvis said, well, I don't know all of you guys. He goes, let's sit down. I've got a couple of great stories to tell you, he says. And so we're going to sit down, but all the chairs are on the perimeter of Studio B. Elvis sits down on the tile, and it hadn't been swept since that morning. He sits down on the tile, and we formed a circle around him. We're all getting our pants dusty, you know. And he began, and you talk about a great raconteur.
Yeah.
He told stories for 2 hours. He went from being the superstar to being another. I said to my friends later, he's just like all the boys I grew up with. Well, you know, Tupelo is only 70 miles from Florence, Alabama, where I live.
Yeah.
And the only thing we cared about was cars and girls and cheeseburgers, right? And Elvis was, here he is, he's 35 years old. I'm 28 at this point. And I don't think he's changed much. So he's telling the silly stories about girls trying to break in at Graceland and how they steal his clothes. And by the time we were ready to record 2 hours later, I felt like I'd known Elvis Presley my whole life, you know?
Yeah. And that 2 hours, you guys are getting paid as session musicians that whole time. Well,
we were actually getting paid 2 hours before that.
Yeah.
In Nashville,
waiting on him to show up.
But sessions ran from 6 to 9, 10 to 1 a.m. in Nashville, right? Well, Elvis always booked 6 to 9, 10 to 1 a.m. open-ending, right? Well, he never came till 8 o'clock. He's 2 hours late. He tells stories until 10 o'clock. Now I've made a session with an hour overtime, and I haven't played a note. And I'm really liking this, you know? I'm getting some rest. And at 10 o'clock, Felton Jarvis came out of the control room and said, Elvis, now, got a lot of work to do this week. You know, because you remember, we're going to do a second Christmas album. We're going to do a second gospel album. Oh, you wanted to do an album of country standards. And I got 7 or 8 pop tunes. Well, that was 37 sides, right? And so we start about 10 in the evening, and we would go till about 5 a.m., and at which point the band would just be dragging. Because some of us had early morning sessions, afternoon sessions, you know. But you know what? We were getting 4, 5, 6, 7 tracks done. Okay. We played it until the king got it.
Wow. Yeah.
And I would say a normal amount of takes was 2 to 3. We had a few songs that he was just learning that were tough. Like we did You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, the old Dusty Springfield standard. And we did Bridge Over Troubled Water. That was just on the radio then. And he had trouble with Bridge Over Troubled Water because he's really late and his throat was bothering. He came in overdubbed his vocal on that. But a lot of times he got on the first take. And that was murder for us, because they would play a demo of the song. And it would be a guy who could imitate Elvis's voice. And the guy would be, "Had I been telling you," and Elvis would be saying, "Had I been telling you." So the imitator is imitating the original Elvis, and Elvis is imitating the imitator. And we're writing out all the changes. Now, the band could all write music out in shorthand. So we're taking down all the changes. And so Elvis might run it 2 or 3 times. He hasn't never heard the song. He's learning it, okay? And we're waiting for him so we can play the song. And that might take 15 minutes. They turn and he'd say, "You guys got that? Oh, do we have it? We've had it for 10 minutes." Wow. And he'd say, "What key was that?" And Briggs would say, that was in key of D. He'd say, "Take it up a little bit." David would give him E flat. "Take it up some more. Give him an E. A little more. Give him an F. Let's try that. What's that? F." We would write it out in numbers 1 through 7 rather than A, B, C, D, F, G, right? So now all of my numbers, I write F up there. All I have to do is think the F scale. All my numbers work, okay? And we start playing it. And so we play it down once with the engineer. And nobody makes any mistakes. These are professional musicians. Now, we haven't worked out the intros, the endings, and some little turnaround things. And the king would say, "Hey, let's put one down." And the red light's on. So the second time we play it is the first time we do a take. And as soon as that's done, Elvis runs in the control room to listen to it. And while he's in there, we're playing a better intro, better turnarounds. We're doing some musical things. And if he plays it twice, Uh-oh, he's thinking of keeping it. We're in trouble, okay? And we came up with this little scheme where we'd take turns. We'd walk in there and stand beside him. And he'd say, "Hey, Putt, what do you think?" I'd say, "Well, I got a couple of ideas for the chorus. Could you do it one more time for us? Oh, and James wants to take the intro. David's going to take the first ending. And Charlie McCoy is going to take the chorus. Okay. Oh, well, let's do one," Elvis would say. Right? He never, ever looked at me and said, "Well, I got mine. Why didn't you get yours?"
Wow.
I remember one night I walked in there. This is after 3 or 4 days of recording. Okay. And we're pals now. And I'm standing beside him. I didn't say anything. He looks down at me and goes, "You want to see me do it again, don't you?" And he laughed. He said, "You think this is difficult? Listen to this." And he went out and did a better one. Okay.
There's so many stories about Elvis in the studio. If he was engaged in the songs or the time that he was involved in that session, he could be focused, he could be distracted. You got him in June of 1970. Your first session with him that you're talking about is June of 1970, five nights. And like you said, those multiple sessions. It's been called since then the Nashville Marathon. Elvis, I don't think, was any more prolific than he was in those five sessions. 34, I think, songs. Probably you would know better. You were there. 34, 35.
I think there were 37, but a couple of them were new songs, and we really didn't get them worked up fast enough.
Yeah. But these songs were on Elvis albums for the next several years. Elvis Country, That's the Way It Is. So many things. And then you had other sessions, but that session, and I do want to give credit to all those other musicians. There's a very famous photograph of Elvis during those sessions with all of you. And I noticed how you got to Elvis's right with his arm around you. That was a very good position for history for you to be in there.
No, Elvis came, he broke the line and got between me and Al Pachuki, the engineer. Okay? But by the way, that was Saturday morning. We had finished the last take. And at last, we're going to get to go home and go to sleep. It's about 5 a.m. If you look at that picture closely, I've got some doctored versions of it. We had sweat all over our faces, our armpits, and we were worn out. You know?
Is that photo was taken the last morning of the last session, the fifth morning?
Oh, yeah, it was over.
According to the logs, the last thing you guys did of those 37 songs is Patch It Up. So I can understand how you might be sweating.
Oh, that wore me out, man.
That is a nonstop bass line.
Well, I love that bass line, but he got it so quick. If I could, Bobby Moore, the great bassist in Nashville, you know?
Yeah.
When I was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame or something, Bobby had gone as the first bass player. I went as the second one. And he came up to congratulate me, okay? And he whispered in my ear, and he said, "We were the best, weren't we?" Well, you know, there were a lot of Elvis stuff. But we then had drinks together. I said, "Hey, Bobby, my favorite thing you ever played was King of the Road with Roger Miller." I said, "That was a great bass part." He said, "Yeah, but I could have used another one." That's the way I felt about Patches.
Never satisfied. The other musicians that were there during that session, and I want to give them credit, James Burton on guitar, who's the only band member from Elvis's stage band, mm-hmm. which had opened in Vegas just a few months before that, back in the summer of 69. You on bass, Chip Young on rhythm guitar, mm-hmm. your childhood friend David Briggs on piano, Charlie McCoy on harmonica and bass and organ and probably anything else Charlie McCoy can get his hands on because he's such an incredible musician, and Jerry Kerrigan on drums. That's the core unit of the Nashville Marathon for those 30 some odd songs that and you mentioned Bridge Over Troubled Water. That's one that Elvis had heard on the radio and liked it. And this is in the days before you could just go on your phone and listen to how the song goes. I mean, who had the most pressure on that song, putting it together?
Well, David Briggs. It was on the radio. It's I don't know, maybe it's heading up the charts. It's number one or something. And I would hear it driving into my first session. And Elvis turned to us and he said, "Have you guys heard Bridge Over Troubled Water?" And, you know, was it Paul Simon? No, Simon and Garfunkel, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we said, yeah. He said, I think I want to do that. And Briggs said, well, somebody go get a copy because it's a great piano part. And I want to make sure I play it right. Elvis said, oh, David, just play something. Wow. And so I have to tell you, now, Larry Nechtel, who was one of the great L.A. keyboard players, okay, played that original part. It was so good, they gave him a Grammy that year.
Wow.
As a side man. It had never happened before. So David plays a rough remembrance of Bridge Over Troubled Waters, and here comes Elvis, you know?
Yeah.
When we cut the track, it was really late, and he was tired, and they said, I'll overdub it. He came in early the next day with Felton and put that great vocal on there. And that's one of the best vocals I've ever heard him do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Paul Simon said that he was so shocked. He said when he found out Elvis was going to do it, he wasn't that excited. And then when he listened to it, you know, Elvis made it a manly song. He put the low. Yeah, Garfunkel was always up there in the stratosphere.
Yeah, he made it a tougher, more dramatic. I think one of his quotes was, you know, Elvis did it very dramatically, but when you think about it, it's a dramatic song that needed that, and that's what Elvis did. But Norbert, you and I have done a few appearances over the years, and you'll give a 1 hour kind of, we'll do a conversation and I'll lead you into talking about your career. And one of your great stories is about Bridge Over Troubled Water, because as much as you are a part of the sound of that song, we found out as you were recreating it, especially at the Country Music Hall of Fame, Norbert, you don't do anything for a minute 20 in that song. You don't do anything.
That's when I was having a sip of my. What was I drinking in those days? It was. it wasn't Suave in those days, you know. It was Chablis. I had a good bottle of Chablis over there, you know, and so which is a nice white. You guys ever had a Chablis? It's a white.
Yes,
white.
I have. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Well, I find young people never heard of Chablis.
that can only come from France. Chablis it has to be French to be a Chablis.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
It's a region, I think.
Sophisticated podcast, by the way.
It is. We talk wines. I said he was a raconteur. Norbert, you talk in your book about your music notes, volume one. Your autobiography, uh-huh. Volume one, ambitious in its scope. But as I read it, I realized there's a chance, an outside chance, I might be in volume two, maybe volume three. Surely by volume four, I should become a part of your story.
Well, but I've always loved you so much, I never wanted to punish you. In my book, you know?
Yeah, really. That's great. But you talk about it's not, sometimes it's not what you play, it's what you don't play.
Well, the best stuff I ever played was the stuff I never played. I can tell you that. But I did remember from Simon and Garfunkel's record that the bass didn't come in. Mm-hmm. The whole first part was the piano and the vocal. Oh, by the way, the guy who played it was Joe Osborne from down in Shreveport, Louisiana. Joe Osborne came to California with James Burton, and they played behind Ricky Nelson together.
Wow.
Joe Osborne goes on and becomes the most recorded bass player, I think, in those decades. He went to L.A. to learn to read music. You have to learn to read music. And just a great player. And that entrance that I play, I believe, is pretty much what he played. I did make note when I heard it that I loved the way the bass entered that song, the second verse.
Yeah.
So I probably swiped that from Joe Osborne.
Well, it's an homage if you admit to it. Yeah, it's an homage. That Nashville Marathon is not the only session you guys did. You did many sessions over the years in the early 70s. You did the one session where there were a lot of gospel songs cut for the He Touched Me album and some of the Christmas songs from the Wonderful World of Christmas.
Yeah.
So you saw Elvis over a number of years, including that last year, that last session in 1976 at the Jungle Room. Now, there you are. You've worked at RCA Studio B. You've worked at Stax with Elvis in Memphis, and then you play in you come to the Jungle Room, which has been turned into a studio. So you were in three different places with the King and musicians making music. What can you say about these places that you played, the Stax and the Jungle Room and Studio B?
Well, I remember going to Stax. That was in 73, I think. Now, I'm producing all the time now, right? Mm. I'm not playing record dates anymore. And I remember Stax, I was in California producing Dan Fogelberg.
Man.
And we were in Sausalito at the record plant. And Felton called me and said, can you come to Stax for a week? You know, they went in there early with some local guys. I think Cogbill went in there for a couple of nights. And for some, it just didn't happen. And it wasn't like the American Rhythm Section that had been so good in 69. But then they called me up and wanted to know if we could get the sort of the Nashville guys back. But I believe it didn't Ron Tutt play on the sessions at Stax.
Let me see. I've got the Briggs
and Ron Tutt and I can't remember if it was Reggie Young or if James came in.
Ronnie was on the Stax session in December of 73.
Yeah, and that was the first time I really heard him play. He played great on that session, you know. Also, we had a great engineer from New York who came down and got a great drum sound. But I loved all those Stax records. I love Sam and Dave, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. And they really, people talk about the Stax having a certain sound, that funky kind of sound. You can hear it on Promised Land, the albums, the songs that are, you can kind of listen to it, an Elvis fan can go, there's something about the way this sounds that is just kind of funkier than
the
rest.
Well, there's a lot of ghosts in their room. I got to tell you, I went in there and I had chill bumps just walking around.
Wow.
And by the way, the equipment had been taken out. Something had happened. Stax had I forgot, and he came in and took over Stax, and then it went under.
Yeah.
I don't think there was any equipment in the control room. So they had the RCA truck out in the parking lot with umbilical cable coming all the way through to pick us up. And Elvis came in, and it was the first time I noticed a change in him. He had gained a little weight, okay? In 1970, when I recorded him, there was an ounce of fat on that body. He was fighting weight, okay? 73 comes in, and of course, did Priscilla already divorce him by the time we did those sessions?
It was right around that time, yeah.
Because he didn't look rested. He had gained some weight, and he was wearing those workout jerseys, you know? And he appeared to be a little tired, but he got energetic from time to time. I have to tell you. First of all, one of the sessions things that I heard, he's yelling at me and Briggs. He said, hey, Pot, David, come on now. We got to get this. Get back on your instruments. Get back on your instruments. Over in the corner telling jokes and laughing. Our relationship was such with Elvis that he could yell at us. You know, it was like your mother yelling at you, right?
Yeah.
And so we would go over and buckle down and be professional again, you know. And we got some good recordings that week, didn't we?
Oh, those Stacks, because I was, you know, I was a teenager in the 70s, so I'm buying these albums as they're coming out. And the Promised Land album has been one that I just love, because I love, like, If You Talk in Your Sleep and Promised Land and all those just kind of those really funky kind of Stacks. But it's they're spooky, like If You Talk in Your Sleep and Love Song of the Year and My Boy and I Got a Feeling in My Body and It's Midnight. These are some kind of interesting song choices that he put together for those.
You know, I wrote the strings on Midnight, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. This artist we did from Norway was telling me, oh, I loved what you wrote on Midnight. And I said, are you sure I did? I wrote it, and I did.
There's stuff you can learn about you from the fans, which is kind of strange.
Well, you know, they didn't give us any credits on those records in those days.
Right, right.
It was only after the box set started coming out, much later, when they started to remix a lot of it, you know. What's the guy from Denmark who's
Ernst Jorgensen?
Ernst, who's the Elvis expert, except he never met Elvis.
And, well, you know, he's got all the tape boxes, though. So that, you know, you know, you say there weren't any credits on them, but there was credit on Elvis Presley Boulevard to the recording engineer, Tom Brown. So when I was 16, I thought that was a pretty big deal to have my name on an Elvis album. And I found out later from you that he was about a 6'5" African-American. And
that was your papa.
You introduced me to David Briggs. You had told David Briggs that you wanted to introduce him to me and me to him. And you said, I'm Tom Brown. And he thought I was going to be that recording engineer from the Jungle Room. And David's first words to me were, "You've changed."
That's great. That's great.
You know, well, people ask me about what was it like recording with Elvis. I just say he was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I honestly think that Elvis thought, and I imagine this happened in the films he made, but as we were being professionals and recording stuff, he felt that he had to entertain us a bit too. And he would say funny things, he would do funny things, and he was just a very energetic, fun guy to be with.
Yeah. Were you able to, in those times of horsing around, joking around, were you able to actually be able to tell him, you know, I'm doing this because I'm from Alabama and I used to hear you on the radio and I wanted to be, you know, Bill Black?
Well, now that we're talking about Stax, there a thing happened. We would always have lunch every night at midnight because Elvis is not throwing.
Elvis's clock is off 12 hours. Yeah.
Exactly. He would have his breakfast around 6. He was ready to go to the office at 8 o'clock. And then and at midnight, oh, by the way, at the beginning of the week, Felton would say, "Now, okay, we're here in Memphis, we're at Stax, and any kind of food you want, we'll have catering bring it." And so so we would break at midnight, and some nights it'd be Italian, some nights it'd be, I don't know. I think it was along about a Wednesday that I went over and I got a plate of food. And Elvis had his food there prepared for him specially. And he had a cheeseburger, order fries, and a Coke. Okay. and there's a drum riser over in the back, over in the corner. So I'm going to go back there because Lamar Fife up in the front has got all the guys in the corner telling funny stories. Okay. Lamar was a funny guy.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to sneak over there and have a quiet meal. Here comes Elvis. He says, "Hey, can I join you?" Yeah. So we both climb up on the drum riser. We sit down. And he starts asking me all about my family. You know, what did your papa do? How did you get started? I said, "King, it's your fault that all of this happened to me." And we started laughing, you know. I said, "My kids at my school, we were doing Scotty and Bill stuff, and my dad had an acoustic bass. My father once played the bars on Bill Street. Did I ever tell you that, Paul or Tom?"
Yeah. Your father tried to talk you out of being a musician, and it ended up talking you into it.
Well, he said, "Son, I want to tell you one thing." He never got rid of the bass. So when these kids at school were starting it, they said, "You have to be the bass player. You have a bass. No one else did, right?" And so my dad said, "I'll show you how to tune it, but don't ever think," he said, "you can make any money playing that damn thing," is what he called it. He blamed his bass for all the problems he had. And he said, "You know, I played on Bill Street, and son, I would never want you a part of anything like that. There was drugs, there was a reefer, and there was wild women, there were shootings and gamblings going on." And the more he talked, I'm thinking, I could be a part of that.
It's not working, Dad. Yeah.
I sat there and tried not to control my my enthusiasm. So Elvis and I talked, and he had an interesting thing he wanted to ask me about that night. And he called me Putt, you know, which was sort of my nickname in the Nashville studios. No one named Norbert had ever Nashville studios. You know, they were all like the president of BMW was Norbert Schutnauer. So I always says, "Hey, Putt, I want to ask you," he says, "Wembley Stadium has offered us $1 million to come over there and play.
Wow.
And the Colonel doesn't want to do it. He says, Colonel says, if we, the only reason we were so popular there is because they've never seen me. Well, you and I both know, Tom, that anybody that's ever seen Elvis was attracted to. Who's the most handsome man?
Yes, yeah.
Said, what do you think? And I said, well, I want to tell you, at that point, I've been working in England a lot. And the record stores over there had huge cutouts of Elvis, but they were 8 feet tall. And Elvis was all over those record stores. And all. I said, I can't see why you wouldn't be tremendously successful. He says, well, the Colonel doesn't want to do it, you know, and I don't know what to. He said, I have a good mind to fire some of a bitch, you know. And he was, but he never did he? And he never went to England. And I think later someone said it was because Colonel Tom wasn't really Colonel Tom and didn't have a passport, you know. But,
yeah, but, there's a lot of different versions of that. And as we always have said, there was only one person that could have told Colonel to go packing, and he didn't do it. So
yes, and it's unfortunate. I don't know, maybe he had some fear of Colonel Tom, because now we're in Vegas, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you've worked with singers before. There's a, no matter how strong they are on stage and in control of their world on stage or at a concert or in the studio, there's a fragility to some performers, because you're putting yourself out there. You're doing something that people are going to pass judgment on if they like it or they don't like it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. Either people are going to like your music or not like your music. So even Elvis, I would think, has that fragility of, if Colonel made me, what happens if I get rid of him?
Well, I can tell you he had that. As a matter of fact, all the great performers I ever knew, no matter how big they became, before they stepped on that stage, they were a little apprehensive. Could this be the night, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I can't do it. And that was a good thing. That was a good thing, I think.
Yeah. You talked about your nickname of Putt, and we didn't have those liner notes to tell us who these musicians are. We knew James because he would say, play it, James. You know, his name would get name dropped. Mm-hmm. On the live albums, we got to know those musicians because Elvis did introductions, and those were a track on the album. But in 1971 at a session, and I looked it up because I wanted to see, this was the first day of recording on May 15th, 1971 at Studio B. And you're doing some gospel songs, and then you start doing some Christmas songs. And around 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you start doing this Merry Christmas Baby that, it always struck me that it just seems like a song that just kind of started and just kept on going. And over the years, we've heard different versions of it that are in its entirety. I think it must be 10, 12 minutes long, but it's kind of the Merry Christmas Baby jam. And that's where we learned that Putt was a part of the band. Tell us about that, that recording of that famous phrase of Elvis's that he uttered to you in the middle of the song.
Well, first of all, it's a slow blues, okay? But you know, it's Merry Christmas Baby. I'm going, gung, 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 gung. If I could just get through this and get home, I'm going to be great. We did it a couple of times, right? And so we started again. And by the way, I think it was later. I think it was more like 4 or 5 a.m. And I'm thinking, and boy, 5.5 minutes from now, I'll be in my car. I'll be in my bed in an hour. And here we go. Well, you know, it's Merry Christmas. Gong, 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 gong. So I'm sort of leaning back on my stool. I've got my eyes shut. And we get all the way through it, okay? And now we're down at the end, and we're going to fade it. And Elvis, I think he stopped the take, and he said, let's do one more. I went, oh, God, no, hell, forgive me. And we're going to go from the top again, right? Well, somewhere in the middle of that, Elvis looked over, and I think he could see I was mostly comatose. and he said, play it again, James. And he looked over at me and said, what'd he say? Wake up, Putt. He said it like that. You know? And he shot me with his right hand, you know, where you make a pistol thing.
Yeah, yeah.
and shot it at me that night. I woke up and finished the take, but I think that was the last thing we did that night.
Well, it you've dined out on that phrase for a few years. Everybody you said in Europe when you were on tour with the Big Screen Show, everybody would yell "Wake up, putt."
Oh, I've got a placard here. We're playing over in Belfast. Okay, we're playing Belfast, and there are four guys in the front row, and they've got a little some cards that are about maybe 12 inches square, right? And we come out and we start playing. They start unfolding. And you know what it says? It goes across all four of their bodies. And it says, "Wake up, putt." And they're pointing at me and they're pointing at the sign. Like, oh, that's cool. You. That's you. That's and, they so cool. came, and they came backstage and gave it to me. I have it here somewhere.
I told Putt that he is missing a merchandising opportunity with not bringing out coffee mugs that say, "Wake up, putt." You know, like, and then a quote Elvis Presley in quote, "Wake up, putt," in quotes.
No, we could definitely sell that. You know, you know what Americans don't know about Elvis today is that I didn't know this until I played when I took over for Jerry Schiff back there in the Big Screen Show around 2012, I think it was. Schiff had trouble with his hearing and couldn't play well. Well, we went to small towns in Belgium and two or three towns in England, and every one of them had an Elvis shop.
Wow.
They just said Elvis. They sold nothing else. And sure enough, they had coffee cups, teacups. They had all the movies, all the records, all the T-shirts, all the hats, all the stuff. And we got down to Brazil. We went down and we played four nights in São Paulo in a 12,000-seater. With a Big Screen Show. It sold it out every night. And down there, I noticed the second night, a couple. I remember a man and woman, they were sitting in the front row. And his job, she would cry tears and he would wipe her tears away, right? And the next night, they're in the same seats and he wipes her tears away.
Wow.
So there were shops all over Brazil. And it's just the most amazing thing. I think he's probably still making more money than the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or any other giant star. Oh, my cardiologist. 2 years ago, I had to put a couple of stents in my heart just to keep from dying.
Yeah, and well, that's, you know.
My cardiologist, she's a runner and a climber, and Stacy Davis. And Stacy was going down to South America. It's not the Pyrenees. It's the Andes, isn't it? The mountain range.
You got me.
And I said, "Well, what are you going to do? We're going to march up to about the 12,000-foot mark." I said, "Well, are you going to take any oxygen?" "No, no." I said, "Well, have a look up there and see if there's any Elvis shops up there." She said, "You, right?" All right. So I get a photo from her for her iPhone. They're up there with the guides who take them higher. And those round buildings that they build, you know, they have them in Afghanistan, yukes or something they're called.
Yeah.
There's one in the front of it has a big sign. It says Elvis.
Oh, my God.
Elvis, 9,000 feet up. Andes.
Elvis is everywhere. He truly is everywhere. Norbert, the career that you had and continue to enjoy music and listening to music and giving talks and lectures and offering your expertise. You designed the sound studio that Delta State University uses for recording classes. You also had the opportunity to produce a couple of great artists, Dan Fogelberg being among them. That's when I first became familiar with the name Norbert Putnam, not from Elvis albums, but from Dan Fogelberg albums and from Jimmy Buffett albums. Mm-hmm. That's when I saw Norbert Putnam listed as a producer. Found out later you also kind of played bass with that Presley kid. What can you tell us about working with Dan and working with Buffett over those number of years and number of albums?
Well, I started with Dan. You know, I wasn't really planning to be a producer. I'd helped a young guy named Chris Christopherson. He came to Nashville, and he pretended that he was homeless. He never mentioned the fact he'd studied in Oxford, okay? He'd studied the English literature, I think, Christopherson. I come into CBS studio one day, and there's this guy standing there, And he's got faded out jeans, a faded out black t-shirt. His hair is all disheveled. He's wearing some boots. I don't know where he found these boots. It looks like he made them himself. And he came over and he said, you're Norbert Putnam, aren't you? And I said, I am. My name's Chris. I'm helping Charlie. You want me to empty that ashtray over there? I said, well, yeah, you can do that because I don't smoke, you know. Well, I'm going to be helping Charlie here. Well, Charlie, the guys who like Chris, they made $35 a week, right? And we found out he was living in the attic of an old house nearby. And I would, you know, he would come over. And one day, after about three months, he said, could you get a beer with me at 5 o'clock on your break between 5 and 6? I got something I want to talk to you about. Well, I figure that he's broke and he needs some money. So I stopped and got $50 to take him and met him at Ireland's. That's had great steak and biscuits. I'm going to give him a good meal because this guy, he doesn't even eat well, right? And so we're sitting there. He orders the steak and biscuits. He said, the reason I wanted to talk to you, I actually came up here to try to be a songwriter. Mm. Well, my heart stops anytime anybody said that to me in Nashville because they said that to me sometimes 4 or 5 times a week, right? And so I made my standard speech. I said, now, Chris, you and 3,000 other people today are trying to become songwriters. And I got to tell you, it's not all that easy, right? Thinking I'll dissuade him. And he said, well, I played some of my songs for Scotty Moore. And and he would say, gimme. This is a guy who has a, he didn't say, give me. He said, Scotty's going to give me a couple hours on a Saturday morning. And I was just wondering if you and Briggs and Kerrigan could help me do some demos on my songs. And I thought, wait a sec, Scotty Moore knows good writing. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm thinking, could this homeless person actually? and so I said, well, I said, okay, here's the deal. I said, the only days we have off to see our families are Saturdays and Sundays. You know, I didn't see my kids so then. And I said, to trying to get anybody to play on Saturdays. Well, I talked to the band. It took about a month to get Kerrigan and Briggs and Chip Young to come over to Music City, of course. Chris comes in. He unpacks his guitar case, and he's got a pint of Southern Comfort. It's 9:30 in the morning. He looked over at me, and he goes, I'm a little nervous singing in front of all of you guys, and I'm just going to have a swig of this. But you want to have a, I said, I think I'm going to pass at 9:30. I just had my car. Well, Chris turned it up. He'd had a drink before, okay? He took down about half. He got his guitar out, and he starts beating on his guitar. And it's good studio musicians. We start writing out the changes, okay? We couldn't hear what he was saying. So we write the music out, and Scotty says, okay, get on the mics, and let's run it down once. And Scotty hadn't set up headphones that day. We can see him over there mumbling, and we're playing the changes to the song. We went through it once. Scotty said, let's record it. We did, and we go in, and Briggs and I are standing there when it comes on. And we hear that voice, that great voice. David leaned over to me, he says, this son of a bitch is worse than Dylan.
Oh, man.
He's up there grumbling. But wait a second. And he got into the chorus. David and I had a publishing company. And I said, wait a second. It's a pretty good lyric. Briggs said, it is a damn good lyric. Well, one of the songs was Help Me Make It Through the Night.
Yeah.
And he took his demos. He had a record deal within a week's time. Not a record deal, publishing deal. And Sammy Smith did that song.
Mm-hmm.
It was a smash. And now Fred Foster is bringing him over to write for Combine. And I'm going to play bass on the first Christofferson record. Okay. So that's, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get off into all of that.
That was great.
All those personalities of people that you worked with. And
but the connection is that later on, I get a call from Joan Baez. And she wants to meet Chris. And so I arranged for them to meet when we're doing the Joan Baez album. And 6 months after that, Joni calls me from California and said, Chris is going to produce my next record. And he wants you to get the band together, the young kids, right? And so I got all the young players. And Dave and I just built Quad Studios. I said, would you come there? So they're coming to our new quadraphonic studio. And I get there and Chris is drunk and he's not going to produce the record. And I said, Chris, let me tell you, if you go in the control room and drink and don't say anything, this band will make her a great record. That's the way the studio guys were in Nashville. You know, I've been talking to her and I think you should do it. Went upstairs. Joni, Chris, she said, Norbert, Chris is drunk. Can you help me make this record? But she wasn't laughing either. Okay. And I said, I can. And 3 nights later, she had a song called The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down.
Yeah.
Like it went top five. Clive Davis flew me to New York, said, I want you to produce for Columbia. And I went overnight from being a bass player who's worn out to producing a Joan Baez record. And that led me to Dan Fogelberg. So I go see Clive and he gives me Dan Fogelberg and Eric Anderson. And so I said, I want you to produce all the folkies on Columbia. I said, I hate folkies. I'm tired. He said, and Clive was great. He goes, no, you don't. You just sold a million copies. You know, she's never sold more than 100,000. You just sold a million copies. I said, do you know that I'm from Muscle Shoals? I love to do horns and black singers. And he goes, I just signed Tom Bell and Gamble and Huff. Well, I knew I was dead there. Those guys, I'm not going to beat those guys, right? And he said, I got this kid from Peoria named Eric Anderson. And he was a little put out with it. He didn't even play. He slid the tape across his desk. Said, take this home and listen to it, Norbert Putnam. And if you will produce this, if you do a good job on this, and this is Clive, he goes, I will make you a very, very, very wealthy young man. I'll take it. I sold out right there. Okay.
Good call. Yeah, good call.
And young Dan was just a genius, you know.
Yeah.
He was 19 years old. And he wrote songs like he'd been doing it for 100 years and could play the guitar and the piano as good as anyone had ever heard, you know.
He had a sound, the albums you did with him, you established kind of that Fogelberg sound for all his records in the future that even you didn't work on.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he kept calling me back to play bass after he loved the way I played the bass. The first record, Home Free, you'll hear an intro things. The bass will go up high and play a little line and go back low to play bass when the vocal came in, you know. And he loved that. And we did those records basically with Dan and Kenny Buttrey and myself, drums and bass and Dan. And we would double those acoustic guitar parts to give you that sound. And we would detune the B string or the G string slightly that gave it a little bit of phasing effect, okay? So that became his acoustic sound. But he was a great keyboard player and I don't know. It took a while to break him, you know, and
yeah.
I just did a documentary thing. I send the record up to Clive. It's called Home Free. Clive calls me and goes, I hate the record. I'm not promoting this record. There are no singles on this record, Norbert. I said, well, you're probably right about the singles, but boy, this kid's writing. I said, duh. I said, so you're not going to promote the record? No, I got to have a hit single. I said, well, would you play it to the women up there at CBS? Well, Bonnie Garner was his secretary. The women went in and said, we'd love Dan Fogelberg the way Norbert's presented him, you know?
Yeah.
Well, Dan starts out and Bonnie calls me. She says, he's playing Passim's over in Cambridge in Boston. Let's go over this weekend and see how he does. We go to Passim's. It's a coffee shop. There's seven people in there and none of them know who's playing. Dan had an upright piano. He put it out in the middle of the stage. And put the back of the piano to the audience, you could just see the top of his head, okay? And Bonnie, it's going to be a lot of work. She goes, it's going to be a lot of work. And so Dan goes on this little tour, and nobody's showing up. Bonnie's calling me. He had 12 people here. He had 9 people there. And one night, my phone rings, and it's Dan. Norbert, I'm in Jackson, Mississippi. There's 2,000 people here to see me. Local radio station, the FM, started playing him. And boy, he was big at Ole Miss and he was big there. And so we got to tell Clive. We tell Clive, Clive says, I'm still not promoting the record.
But that launched Dan. And then when you were with Buffett, in the early years. And I've seen the multi-platinum album you've got for Margaritaville. You keep it. So you told me once you keep it where everyone will see it, you have it in the bathroom. you have that, and that's the way it is. I think is also in the. But you said, I said, why'd you put these in the bath? You said, I want everybody to see them.
Do you know where I got the bathroom thing? Mm. I was working with George Harrison over there in the mid 70s.
Oh man,
we did sing an act for him, and we'd have to record it at his studio, as part Cracker Box Palace. You know, it was a 44 room estate on 30 acres, one night we're sitting in the big room with a fireplace you can stand in, burning logs, and they're serving us drinks. And I said, George, I said, do you have a trophy room? Because there was nothing in there that said music until you went to the studio. But there wasn't his guitars. There wasn't the gold records. Oh, he said, I got a special room for him. Would you like to see them? And we marched down this long hallway. And we open an oak, dark, stained door that's 10 feet tall. We go into the bathroom, platinum records, wall to ceiling in there. All day. And he said, you know, I put him in the shitter. That's the word. He was the material world man, right?
Exactly. Well, tell us about those early years with Buffett, because you kind of helped him define his sound as well.
Well, yeah. My good friend, Don Gant. Don Gant played violin in the Nashville Youth Symphony. He could sight read anything. He was a great vocalist. And he was producing for Acuff Rose. And he got young Buffett and did Come Monday. Great record. That was his first radio record. And they call it a radio record. It made it to the top 20, but it only sold 125,000 singles, right? But Jimmy had enough money to hire a good band. He goes on the road. And he comes back about 9 months later to Don Gant and marches in and says, well, the record did pretty good, but I want to use my band to play on this next record because they have more energy than these studio guys. I understand that. Okay. I was a studio guy.
Yeah.
And Don Gant says, I'm not working with amateur drummers and amateur musicians because the studio takes too long to learn that. And Don Gant was right about that. So Don's manager was a guy named Don Light. And Light said, why don't you talk to Norbert Putnam? He might do it. And so my favorite restaurant, a French restaurant named Julian's, he called me. I said, well, meet me. My dinner party will be over at 9 o'clock and we'll sit in the bar by the fireplace and tell me about what you want to do. So Jimmy comes down, we open a bottle of champagne and he's telling me how great his band is. I said, well, how would you describe your band? He says, well, we're more like the Rolling Stones than some Nashville studio band sitting in the chairs. Well, I'm sitting there trying to imagine the Rolling Stones playing Come Monday.
Yeah.
And I said, I just don't know. And he said, well, would you come and see my band? Oh, I said, are you playing anywhere near Nashville? We're playing out on Hermitage Landing next week. Oh, well, that's out by the airport. I said, I'll come and see the band and I'll tell you what I think. I went out there. I loved the band. They were a rock and roll band. They put energy behind all those folk songs. And I thought, boy. I said, Buffett, call me tomorrow. He calls me the next day. Play me songs. He plays me all these songs about the Caribbean, drinking and sailing, carousing in the Caribbean. Right. And at the time, you know, Sam Phillips was born here in Florence, Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, Sam said that he said that whatever endeavor you're thinking about going into, whether it's a gas station selling cars or insurance, you need to think of a different way to look at it and do it. And I applied that to a lot of the acts that came out. I'm thinking about Buffett. Now, here he is. All these songs about sailing in the Caribbean. I said, Jimmy, what if we were to use wooden flutes, you know, like recorders and steel drums and some ship's bells clanging. And he goes, oh God, that's like a Michener movie. Are you kidding? And he got up and he left and I didn't think I'd ever see him again. Right. And, I thought, well, that didn't go well. And 10 days later, he calls me. He goes, you know that idea you had about maybe some of those marimbas and steel drums and and trying to create a, I said, exactly, a persona for your music. He says, well, I think that might actually work. Uh-huh. Hmm. And I said, so what do you want to do? Well, I started writing the first song. Oh, I guess we're going to work together. I said, well, what's it called? He said, it's Changes in Attitudes, Changes in Latitudes. We're leaving Nashville and going to the ocean. And I'd also said to him, if we do it down there, I said, I want to do it down there. I want to do it in Nashville. We can't make a record about the ocean and on the Cumberland River. So we all went down there. And while we were there, oh, now I told you guys, I didn't mention this, but I became a producer so that I didn't have to work all day and all night. The producer, he's like the director of the movie, right? So I worked, only worked from 11 to 5. And Buffy goes, 11 to 5? So you don't work at night? Never again, I said. I said, you'll be amazed. I said, you and I are going to have breakfast together every day and dinner every night. And we're not going to talk about, so we work from 11 to 5, we get two tracks, and then we go to dinner and talk about the day's work, and did we do it right, or do we have to change anything? Well, Jimmy moved his, he bought a used sailboat and moved over to Coconut Grove. So at 5 o'clock, we're in our car with 2 six-packs of Budweiser, go down to Coconut Grove, crank up the diesel, pull her out, pull her into the wind, and play the day's work, you know? And that was how we... That's how, that was how his persona came about, you know?
Yeah. And that shows also too, the businessman that he became in later years, always understanding, you know, that persona and how that persona can be used to the advancement of really everything. He created an entire industry of parrot heads and parties. And you were such a part of that with the beginning of that.
Well, you know, but he embellished everything I said to him. He put the palm trees on stage and he put the girls in the grass skirts, which really didn't happen to the Caribbean.
Well, it's a mash. It's a personification of what we think life in the islands is.
I did total 6 albums in a row with Buffett and all of them. And then the box sets that came. His Beaches, Boats, and Bars thing was only the Eagles outsold us that year.
Yeah. You were, you've met my buddy Scott here in Tupelo, Scott Reed. I knew Buffett in the 70s because Scott was I was the Elvis person and he was the Buffett person. And going over to his place as teenagers and sitting and reading the Buffett albums, who did have lyrics and credits that Elvis albums didn't have, and seeing that Norbert Putnam name there, I came to associate you through seeing your name on Fogelberg and on Buffett albums. And I think that's been one of the most incredible things about getting to know you first through the Elvis world, but then realizing, oh my gosh, you've just had so many people that you have been a part of. And, you know, I believe you're the first person we've interviewed on the podcast that just worked into conversation. George Harrison. You know, I mean, that's just, you know, I do the same thing when I impress people. I say, well, Norbert Putnam said to me, and they stand back in awe.
Well, listen, you'd like, I never meet anybody ever heard of me. Okay. And if you really want to be humbled, go to your hometown. Right?
Yeah, really.
Talking about hometown, they didn't even invite me to any of the meetings for the most music association. And Jimmy John, the Alabama Music Hall of Fame put us in there back there years ago. And so I come home and I go over there and I can't find any pictures of us. Oh, it's down in a corner somewhere. One small picture of the original Muscle Shoals rhythm section. I see Jimmy Johnson, you know, they came along 7 years later. And of course, they've made all those great records. David Hood on bass, great player. And I see Jimmy Johnson one day, and I said, Jimmy, did you just write us out of the history? He said, well, you left. You left.
Well, I love those early songs of yours with when you guys were teenagers, you know, Jimmy Hughes, Steal Away, all those early things. Yeah. Those are some great things. Clarence Carter, I'm a big Clarence Carter fan, too.
Yeah. Well, Muscle Shoals was a miracle, okay?
Yeah.
And you know, I tell that story, and you've heard it when you did those book things with me about a young guy named Tom Stafford who collected a bunch of teenage guys who were 16 years old to come over and do demos on new songs. And between 16 and 17, we're trying to come up with original parts, the worst songs you've ever heard. Tom would sign anybody can make a rhyme, okay? But one day, after 2 years of doing this after school, Arthur Alexander, the black bellhop to Sheffield Hotel, came up the steps, and he sang two songs a cappella to us because he couldn't play an instrument. Great writing, good-looking guy. And right behind him, a day or two later, came Rick Hall, the entrepreneur we needed. And Rick said, I'll build a studio and I'll produce Arthur. And he did, okay? He took it to Nashville, made a deal with Dot Records. Record made the top 20 in America. And over in Liverpool, a guy named Brian Epstein, who ran the record shop, handed it to a young John Lennon.
Mm, yeah.
An old Tom Stafford, who said, we're going to have a publishing company here. The Beatles did the B-side, which was called Get a Shot of Rhythm and Blues, and the Stones did the A-side, You Better Move On. And Muscle Shoals was off and running. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. And Norbert Putnam was hanging on.
Oh, boy. I said to my father, I may be able, this could be a career opportunity.
didn't have to leave town. Hey, Norbert, thank you so much for spending this time with us this afternoon. I've been looking forward to having you on here and talking. And I said this before we brought you on, that you're the one. If somebody said, Tom, you've got an hour on stage, who do you need to get through the hour? I would say, give me Norbert Putnam and we'll be fine.
And one question. All you have to ask is one question. I'm sorry. I rambled on you.
Yeah, all I said during the a couple of them was just, would you like some more Chablis, Mr. Putnam? Hey, Norbert, thank you so much. And my love to you and to Cheryl and the dogs. And it's been such a great thing. And Big Lou and Alex, we're all just been sitting back just loving the story.
This was great, Norbert. Thank you so much. So
thank
cool.
you.
Oh, it was my pleasure. All right, guys, I'll go take the dogs out.
There you go. Thank you, Norbert. We appreciate it. Talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right.
That was so great. That was so great.
He's just like those stories. He's not name dropping. It was George Harrison. It's just amazing.
Well, I thought it was so cool of George that he did it.
It's just George. He was just, you were just talking to your friend George, and that was it. You know?
Hey, can I tell them one short story on George?
Sure,
oh, please.
I can do really quickly.
You're still rolling out?
Yes, yes.
Cool. We have bonus content.
And then I got a story I want to tell Norbert too that puts us in tight circle there. Yeah, let's hear the George Harrison story since we're just hanging around.
Well, when George had hired me to come over, it's mid 70s. I'm in Los Angeles. I would go out to LA to find gigs. Oh, by the way, no one in Nashville ever hired me to produce a record.
Wow.
No. Norbert Putnam is this guy who's trying to do pop music down here, and it's going to ruin everything. And plus that, all the guys he produces can write their own songs. Nashville was a publishing town, okay? Mm-hmm. And the publishers controlled everything. But anyway, I'm out in California looking for a gig, and I bump into Dennis Morgan, who ran Dark Horse Records for George Harrison. Now, I hadn't seen George. Oh, by the way, our first Muscle Shoals rhythm section in 63 opened the first Beatles concert in Washington.
Wow.
They came down and did the Ed Sullivan Show on Sunday. Then Tuesday, they came down to Washington. And I think it was Paul McCartney had called Tommy Rowe. We were cutting hits with Tommy Rowe. And they had opened for Tommy in Germany, where they had a deal. And they said, would the Muscle Shoals guys be the backup band for our opening acts in Washington? And it paid a lot of money, so we went up there, okay? But we couldn't stay. We get there, we've got invitations to the British Embassy at 11 o'clock. We have a midnight flight back to Nashville to be in the studio with Rick Hall the next morning at 10 o'clock. Okay. But the Beatles, later when George, I see him in LA, he says, I got this group in Scotland, and they were called Splinter. And he said, I produced their first record, and they hated it. They told me it sounded like a Beatles record. He said, would you come over and produce them? And he was looking at me because I've got Scotch-Irish blood, and I had a little red in my beard. He said, oh, God, I love you. So I went to England, and And we made a record. I don't think they like my record any better than they like George's record. But I got to know George. And so a year or two goes by, and some friends in Nashville are planning a trip to go to London for Christmas time. And my wife and I said, well, we'll join you. I think there was about eight of us, four couples. And so we're having great fun at Christmas time in London. I'm thinking, I'm going to call George and just see if he's home, you know. Now, George is a Hindu at this point, so I don't know what I'm going to wish him, you know. but I've got his home phone number. I call down and I get the little recording device, right? You remember those, what do we call those things that we had on our phones? That we record a message and play it back? So I get his answer machine. I said, hey, George, it's Norbert. I'm at the Dorchester. I said, if you come up to London this week, I'll buy you a drink in the bar, okay? And I hung up. So I didn't expect to hear from him. The next afternoon, he called, Norbert, George here. He says, can you come down? I said, well, I said, I'm here with a ton of other people. What is it? He goes, I really need to talk to you about something. Oh, God. I said, well, it's really going to be hard for me to get away from these people. Oh, bring them. Bring all of them. I said, are you serious? I mean, these people never met a Beatle, you know?
Yeah.
Said,
no.
And then he lays out the trip. He says, well, you take the train down to Reading, and then you change in Reading, and you come on down to Henley. And I'll book rooms for you at the Red Lion. And then... have dinner there, and then walk up to the house at the top of the hill, and we will entertain them by the fire, and at a certain time, around midnight, I'll look at you, and you will say, "Well, George, thank you so much. We better get back down the hill," and then you come back, and that's exactly what happened. George and his wife, what is her name? She served them drinks by the fire. And George said, and where did you come from? Oh, you grew up in the Ozarks. Tell me about that, right? Wow. And finally, he actually took them down the hall to see his guitar collection. You know, his psychedelic guitar. And these, I've never seen people so wide-eyed. And at the delegated time, I said, George, thank you so much. We got him back down the hill, right? I walked back up, and we were there until daylight.
That's
like James Bond. He had it all planned out.
Well, George was a smart cookie, I have to tell you.
Yeah.
He said, Norbert, I want to play you three songs I recorded because I'm thinking of quitting. My last record only sold 300,000 in America. And I've had some of my friends in. Eric was in the other day. I played it to Eric. and they said, I want you to tell me honestly, have I lost it? And I sit there, and he hit the tape, and here come those multiple slide guitars. And it's, you know, George, there wasn't anybody like George, was there? Yeah. He was great, George.
Oh, my God.
And so after the second song, I said, George, I don't want to hear anymore. I said, you're still George Harrison. You got to keep doing this. Well, that's what Eric said. and he said, well, let's have a drink. And we talked till the morning. He said, I want you to tell me all about Elvis.
Wow.
And I said, well, I can tell you this. You know, I only see him in the studio. We don't hang out, you know. And I started telling him about all of Elvis's talents, how quick he was, how he could nail a part on the first take. And he said, you know, we went up to see him that time. And we were so nervous, we all got stoned in the car. He thinks we're a bunch of imbeciles. then we made this deal. I said, I'll tell you all about Elvis, and you'll tell me all about the Beatles. And so when it was my turn, I said, I want to know who did what with the Beatles. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I know George Martin wrote all those great orchestral parts that really brought life to all those songs.
Yeah.
He said, you know, Paul sang him all those parts. I said, well, how did you feel about everything? He says, well, we were never anything more than Paul's backing band. Mm. Oh. And he said, He said, we would do all the Lennon McCartney songs. And at the end, he'd look at me and say, come in and do your song tomorrow. And he said, the day we did Something the Way She Moves, I came in. It was just me and Ringo and George Martin.
Wow.
You know, but he did say, he said, I have to admit, though, they were such great writers that I really had to bring my game up to a higher level to compete. Yeah. And I don't know if I would have ever written Here Comes the Sun with all those chord changes and time changes. I was really having to compete with the two greatest writers in the world.
Wow.
But he was such a lovely guy. And I can't tell you, when George died, it really hurt me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I went back down the hill about daylight. I didn't call him. It was years before I told him the reason. So I, yeah.
But I love that he cared enough about, yeah, bring them on up. I'll let him meet a Beatle. And then
he treated them.
Exactly.
I didn't say anything. He wanted to talk to all of them about where they came from and what they were doing.
Wow.
And they were just so happy. George was like that, you know?
Yeah.
He would come and have a drink with me down at the Red Lion Bar. Red Lion only had 13 rooms. The bar was the size of a bar in my house here. You know, he put about 8 people in there. And he came down one day, George would walk into the bar, there'd be 7 or 8 people. They'd all look up, they'd look back at their glasses, they never touched him, never came near him. Okay. And he would say, Norbert, you tell Elvis he can come and hang out with me and Henley and nobody will bother him.
Oh. Wow.
And I'm thinking, and we'd walk to the shops and nobody bothered him.
Yeah.
I just couldn't see that happening with Elvis Presley, you know?
Yeah. I love that. Even a Beatle was an Elvis fan, you know, just when it gets down to it, everybody was.
Well, John said without Elvis, there was nothing.
Yeah.
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 I'm sorry. I'm wearing you out.
My God, this is great. Oh,
Norbert, thank you so much. And your check is in the mail, my friend.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and check my gold records in the shitter here. You know. I'm going down and see the dogs.
Norbert, this is Jeff speaking. I just want to tell you, thank you so much. What an honor. Those are some of the best stories I've ever heard. But you and I actually have a connection.
Oh, what's that?
Well, a few, actually. John Briggs signed me at ASCAP.
Oh, John's great.
And I recorded in Muscle Shoals several times. I was a session singer in Nashville back when, before tuners. But I was in a band for 7 years. With your nephew, Boyd LaFon.
Oh, and he's a great player, isn't he?
Yeah, he's
a great player.
And it was with a band called the Hillbilly Bastards, and Tom T. Hall's son, Dean Hall, was the guitar player, and Boyd played bass, of course, and I was the singer. And we won't put this in the podcast, but when I met you in Nashville, I had asked you about a story. Boyd couldn't really remember the story, but it had something to do with, he thought Elvis threw your bass in Studio B down the alley, but he was mad at you. But then you told me the real story. Do you remember this?
Oh, I dropped my bass.
Well, okay. And you thought the session was over.
Yeah. Before the session was over, it was really late and it looked like the session was over. Matter of fact, we signed the time cards. That's what you did last. And we were leaving. We go out in the parking lot, and Jerry Shook was out there with his RV van. Shook was another Nashville guitar player. It was great. And we came on board, and he lit up a few stogies there. I just had a couple of hits, and Felton comes out and says, "Oh, he wants to do one more song." Oh God! Now wait a second. So we go back in, and I must have looked like the most stoned of the whole group, because Elvis turned to me and he said, "Putt, count it off." He had never asked me to count it off before. And I'm sitting up there on my stool with my bass, and I never wore a strap on my bass, right? And I said, 1, 2, and it slid off my lap and went bam in the floor. The amplifier, like the end of there. And Elvis ran out. that was the story.
So great, because it's just such a real story, you know. I mean, just kind of behind the velvet rope, behind the curtain thing. I love that story.
Well, you know, he didn't hold it against me. I don't think he really wanted to do another song. But somebody told me that they were on a flight to L.A. with him the next day, and he mentioned that the musicians were all potheads down in there.
Man.
But he didn't stop calling me.
Exactly.
Maybe he had a toke or two himself.
Okay.
Well,
you better take those dogs, Putt. You better take those dogs outside.
Okay. I love you guys.
Love you too, Norbert. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Man.
Well, that was one of the greatest moments of my life.
Oh, my God. Wow.
That's great.
I didn't think Schilling could be topped. I'm not saying it was. But that's what just happened is unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
That was, golly, I mean, George Harrison.
Yeah,
you know. So we covered the Beatles, Buffett, Elvis, Fogelberg, Clapton, not a bad little...
Christofferson.
Christofferson.
Yeah, I'm telling you, Volume 1, can you imagine what's going to be in Volume 2?
Jeez.
I'm like, that's the career that, that's the ultimate podcast guest that can go anywhere with you in a conversation.
And for everybody listening, I can't tell you how genuine this moment is between me, Tom, and Alex right now. I mean, I'm almost emotional. That was so cool hearing those stories and the way he told the stories, how unbelievably generous he was with his time. And I love people that have had great experiences in life and tells you about them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that was just, that was first party dead on.
The way he describes it, you're with him
when
he's in the bar with George Harrison, you're with him when he's in the studio with Elvis. The way he tells the story is you're part of the story with him, and he still can't believe these things happen to him, you know? So it's unbelievable. It's just amazing. And like you said, to give us his time like that, that means a lot. And
for him to talk about his dad, basically talking him into playing bass. Like,
you're really not making me want to not do this, Dad, you know? Hey, I hope you guys listen to the podcast have enjoyed that as much as we have. None of us really interjected that much because when you've got a storyteller like that, You let them go. You know, it's not about what to ask and what to do. You let them tell their stories, and one thing leads to another. As he speaks, he thinks about this character, like, oh, you know, to go to Dan Fogelberg through Chris Christofferson.
Unbelievable.
You know, that's he took us back. Like, Fogelberg's in his life because of Joan Baez, because of Chris Christofferson, because of the record guy and the folk and all. I mean, everything connects.
And then, of course, when we're wrapping it up, we're done.
Yeah.
And then he gives us, oh, by the way, the George Harrison story, you know. Yeah.
I don't know how much we'll make the podcast, but as we signed off with him, he didn't click off, and we were talking about how excited we were, and we just hear a voice go, hey, guys, I got one more George Harrison story for you. We're like, go.
He goes, do you mind if I tell it? Yeah.
Oh.
And we might want to make sure that he doesn't mind us telling letting the other story be told, but it sounded like he got a kick out of that. But, you know, we had, for those of you listening, this is a very real moment. We actually did a part of a podcast before we brought Norbert on. Putt, I'll say Putt now.
Yeah.
I don't even know that we need that. we'll do that for another podcast because it was a great subject. But I think that what you're hearing now is a very genuine reaction to a very special moment. And I've been a lucky guy. I've been in all 50 states. I've been about 30, 40 countries. I've met, in a movie with Robert Redford and James Gandolfini and Mark Ruffalo, and have just had some incredible experiences. That makes my top five, if not my top three. Just to hear that, because I'm a country music historian, I'm a music historian, and we just talked to a guy that was a huge part of that history.
Yeah.
And it's just that was really fantastic, and how generous and great of a guy Norbert Putnam is.
it's you know, I it's why I love that podcasts like this exist.
Yes.
To share those stories. Not everyone's had the opportunity to come to Graceland during Elvis Week and hear my conversations with these legends. And a lot of them are returning the favor to me of appearing on the podcast. And I hope to have more. Norbert could come back and we could just do 19. We just pick a year. We could do an hour. Just Norbert, what'd you do in 73? And we could do an hour on just that. So we thank him.
I'm so proud of us because we've had Jerry Schilling. You may have heard of him. Who, you know, manages the Beach Boys. You might have heard of them. And he was so great. His stories were so great. And he was so authentic and so real with us. Now we get this Norbert experience. I mean, it's just, that was just, I'm so glad we started doing this because this moment never would have happened. Everybody listening is probably going, well, Jeff, shut up so I can turn this dang thing off. But I just can't tell you how awesome it was to be a part of that.
Thanks everybody for being with us. And Alex, thank you for struggling and getting us through the technical issues we had that I think no one will be aware that we had those issues. And that's the beauty and the magic of what Alex Mitchell does behind the scenes to get these two people who just barely are able to plug their computers in. Thank you, young man, for what you have done for both of us in keeping us relevant and hip, as the kids say. I believe they still say that. Thanks a lot. And, you know, Jeff, we'll end this the way we always like to end. I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou.
And we're done talking. And so is Norbert Putnam, but we need to get him to talk again sometime.
Absolutely.
Thanks, everybody.